You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. This Valentine's Day, Kingstonians are gearing up for a unique celebration to support the city's most vulnerable residents. Warm Hearts Day is a new grassroots initiative organized by Our Livable Solutions, a charitable organization dedicated to supporting individuals experiencing homelessness. The main events consist of a series of fundraising concerts and a drag and burlesque show on Friday night and a celebratory pancake breakfast on Saturday morning. The initiative has gained significant traction with a long list of community organizations lending their support by distributing care packages to encampments, hosting fundraising events, and writing notes of kindness for unhoused neighbors. Crystal Wilson, Executive Director of Our Livable Solutions, shared the inspiration behind this heartwarming initiative and the work done so far with CFRC.
How did this initiative come to be?
Well, it was, I was a former teacher, kindergarten teacher, and I love children's books. And I happened upon a children's book called Warm Hearts Day that was published by Scholastic. And it's really cute. And it's about a fairy that landed in the forest. And the forest animals had been squabbling. And the fairy said that she couldn't make it back home unless people warmed their hearts or the animals warmed their hearts. So they ended up doing a number of acts of, random kindness. And that enabled the fairy to go home. And then every year they celebrate Warm Hearts Day by doing random acts of kindness for their friends and neighbors. So I thought it was beautiful and it could really tie into the work that we do anyway to help our neighbors without homes. I just thought, and the world is struggling right now and, it's scary and stressful and we needed something really warm and happy to do, and more collaboration in between the groups that are supporting people without homes. So we'll give it a try and see how it goes.
Yeah, this is the first time initiative. What do you think the day is going to kind of look like?
Well, we have two concerts, one at 5:15 at St. James, which is just down the street on Queen's campus. And a second one at 7:30 at St. Andrew's, which is at Princess and Clergy Street. So both are pretty well packed with some other things going on as well. So we have some other groups that are going to be highlighted, local heroes that are helping people without homes and a few treats that people can acquire for Valentine's Day. And information to share with the public as well as the musical event, which will be pretty nice, I think. And then on Saturday, we have a pancake breakfast at Crossroads United Church. And again, there's going to be some extra things happening. A choir is coming in to sing. We'll be there to be able to process birth certificates for people who don't have homes who need birth certificates. I've been picking up donations yesterday and today. It's been absolutely amazing. So far, I have 90 $10 gift cards that are going to be given out through different groups to people who are unhoused. And I know there's another batch coming, but I don't want to say how many yet. But there's a little competition between two faith organizations trying to help each other. And then my truck was filled last night from Shout Sister Choir's initiative to collect items that people need who are unhoused. So I've been kind of going around redistributing, and I stopped at St. Mary's Parish Center today and gave them some stuff they need, and I'll be stopping some other places today as well for that. But they told me to come pick up a bag of things, and then when I got there, their entire couch was filled with bags, and it filled my entire truck. So it's really nice to see people kind of coming together and doing just like these small random acts of kindness that are helping people without homes. So it's just nice to work together with a group of people that are big heart-minded.
Local volunteers, including first-year Queen's University medical students, will also play a crucial role in the day's activities. A first-year Queen's University medical student volunteering, Rachel, joined Wilson to speak about student involvement in this event.
This seems to have become a massive cross-community kind of effort here. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that, as well as the involvement of Queen students in this project.
Well, we when we first discussed the concept of Warm Hearts Day, it was in October. And then we first invited faith organizations in Kingston to participate, because part of it is we get a lot of support from faith organizations, and we know how much work faith organizations put into supporting people and helping people in poverty. But sometimes they get some flack saying that they should do more. But we wanted to highlight that a bit, how much work is actually being done by the different faith organizations. So we put together a letter, an appeal letter, and paired it. There's 121 registered faith organizations in Kingston. And then the postal strike hit. So then Rachel stepped up with her the Queen's first year medical students, and distributed the letters for us, which was a, you know, saving grace. And they have also, the first year Queen's medical students have also offered volunteers for the concerts and for the pancake breakfast. And they've helped us distribute some flyers as well and posters about the event. It's been really nice having the extra support.
Oh yeah, Rachel, I was wondering if you could speak to how you got involved and how your peers kind of got involved in this.
Yeah, so it all first started, I met Crystal, I think it was back in October, during a lecture of ours. We had a panel of people talking about different like healthcare disparities, and Crystal was a panelist. And like, I remember my classmates and I afterwards just being so inspired by the work that you're doing, and also just feeling like we wanted to do something to help the Kingston community. So I reached out to Crystal after and just asked her if there were any things that we could get involved with. She's a great resource in the community as well. She knows like everyone and knows of all the opportunities for volunteering and to help. So I've just been in contact with her ever since. And yeah, she's been helping us get connected to these events to help out.
And you mentioned you've already gotten plenty of donations. The community is really coming together behind us. What are you looking forward to over the next week?
Well, I'm looking forward to the concerts and the pancake breakfast and the opportunities to bring people together. So these three events in particular were created on purpose so that people without homes could attend, because we really see people without homes as our neighbors that need support. So anytime we can bring them together with the regular community and have good positive interactions is really helpful to help people understand the challenges that they're facing. So I'm looking forward to just like, you know, hanging out with people that have, you know, are supportive and have big hearts and care, and the people that we support as well, bringing them all together.
Yeah, all of what Crystal said, I'm looking forward to as well, the concerts and the pancake breakfast. I think both will be a great opportunity to just get more connected to the community. I think as a student, sometimes you live in a bubble, like the university campus bubble. So I know myself and my classmates are excited to just get out of that bubble and just, help out and be surrounded by that good energy and good vibes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am very thankful. Like we interact quite a bit, but I'm very thankful for Rachel's coordination with the people that have stepped up to volunteer, because I'm not sure where we would be without it, because they've provided a lot of the legwork that's gotten this initiative off the ground. So I'm very...
What kind of initiatives are you seeing so far? Because I know folks can sign up to contribute to this initiative, as well as attending the events that are already organized for Friday. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that and the support you've received so far.
Sure. So Shout Sister Choir, who's been absolutely phenomenal supporting the people that we support and supporting our organization. They have normally done concerts for us for fundraising, which has been great. But they decided this time they try something a little bit different, and they did a challenge out to their members and their members' families to just collect socks and underwear and sanitary products and kind of toiletries and stuff. Things that are a little bit harder to come by when you're on the streets, and often we're looking for them in terms of donations. And that's what filled my truck. So they did a great job collecting those. A wonderful lady named Bonnie, she's been a phenomenal volunteer with us, and kind of pops in and out, and she's one of our bingo volunteers. And she sent me some pictures on Sunday, and out of the blue, I had no idea. She set up at the Memorial Center Farmers Market and had a little craft initiative where people could make heart out of different materials. So people could, you know, make a heart or take a heart, and she was looking for donations towards the initiative. So that was pretty nice. It was a nice surprise. We weren't expecting it. Rax, which is a restaurant and bar out in the West End, is collecting food for the Partners in Mission Food Bank. So they have a barrel set up at their site to collect non-perishable food items. So we'll find out more about that next week, how that worked out. And then St. Mark's and Faith United Churches are the ones kind of competing on the gift card. So they're raising funds from their congregation to purchase $10 gift cards for people without homes that'll be distributed. And then we've been collaborating with community groups. So Gnome from a Home, who's going to be on Friday night's concert at St. Andrew's, is a teenager who's been doing this now, I think, for 3 years. She raises money by making greeting cards with this cute gnome character on it and selling the greeting card. And then she donates that money to another organization called Community Friends in Motion, who use the money to buy pizza on Fridays. So every Friday, the money that she raises, Community Friends in Motion distributes pizza to encampments. So that's been, you know, she's going to be at the event. Community Friends in Motion is going to be at the St. Andrew's concert as well. And so Community Friends in Motion is helping us distribute the gift cards, as well as St. Mary's Parish Center on Brock Street. They're going to help distribute the cards to people that are in need. And then Red's Rack has received some of the donations, so they're distributing. Quantum Energy has Quantum Renewable Energy has offered to transport anything that we need. They had originally offered to help us with Crossroads Village with the construction, but because we didn't get off the ground when we were expecting to, we're like, okay, we can't do that, but could you help us with this other thing right now until then? So they stepped up right away and helped. And there's the Amour Cabaret, which is a burlesque show on Friday night. They're going to be making cards of kindness. So they're supplying their audience with materials to make cards. And then they're going to encourage their audience to make cards of kindness. And those are going to be distributed on Sunday to people without homes through Community Friends of Motion. So it's really nice to see people being creative. And, you know, what we encouraged was, don't try to do too much. Don't get overwhelmed. Just like think of little things that you could do that all together, it ends up being a larger initiative, right? Oh, and Chalmers United Church, I love them. They are making chocolate roses and some treats that are going to be at both St. Andrew's and St. James as well. They've been great supporters of our program as well.
That's amazing. Yeah. And what kind of things have you been hearing as, you know, as the event approaches? What have folks been saying to you?
Just the excitement about something really positive. I had a couple of people mention that they are not a fan of Valentine's Day, and they're glad we are transforming Valentine's Day into something different. Just how excited they are to participate in something that's a positive initiative for our community.
Mm-hmm. And are you hoping to perhaps continue this on an annual basis?
I think that we have seen enough support, and knowing that we built this initiative on zero budget, this was just volunteer effort and groups stepping up to support. We didn't have a budget ourselves to make this happen. So we've done this, on a shoestring and a bit of a whim and hope that, and thankful for volunteers stepping up. So we can definitely see this becoming an annual event, just based on the response we've had this year. So we kind of see this year as a pilot project, and then we've learned a lot about how to connect with groups and how to connect with volunteers to do this initiative. So I can see it happening next year for sure.
Awesome. And how can folks participate, whether that's attending the events or creating their own community initiative? How can folks get involved in that?
So we have a website, warmheartsday.com. that shows events and initiatives, and also includes a piece of page about how to participate. But if a group wants to do their own initiative and tie it into it, we'd love to hear about it. And if they want to collect things for any organization, food for the food bank or donations for Interval House or whatever. We have one page on our website that lists most of the organizations. Hopefully we didn't miss any, but who somehow support people without homes. So choose any one of those organizations. They're all great. And find your own way to participate, whether it's, and even if it just means on Warm Hearts Day on the 14th, you send out a kind message on social media. Like, we're encouraging that kind of interaction as well, so that it's a really positive, nice day, because sometimes we hear stuff that's not so nice to people without homes. And so on Warm Hearts Day, we're going to be encouraging people just to send a Facebook message out to the world to say something nice about people who are unhoused, or, you know, through Blue Sky or through Instagram or wherever, you know, even if that's what you can do, then, you know, participate by doing something like that.
Working out this morning, but yeah, obviously I am happy that this could be resolved at the bargaining table, and look forward to seeing the agreement at a ratification vote.
That was Sarah Alux, a caretaker at Queen's University who was involved in getting workers strike ready as negotiations with the university came down to the wire. After extensive discussions right up until late Sunday night, unions representing over 1,000 workers, including caretakers, library technicians, and lab technicians, have reached tentative agreements with Queen's. The university remained, quote, cautiously optimistic in their statements as they continue to update their labor news page throughout negotiations, finally announcing the tentative agreements in a statement on Monday. Workers celebrated their achievements at the bargaining table and the narrow avoidance of a strike at a rally outside of Richardson Hall on Queen's campus. The agreements still need to be ratified by all parties, and full details of the agreements will remain confidential pending their ratifications. However, the mood at the rally was one of hope and relief. Adam Kordick, who was at the bargaining table representing QP254, spoke with CFRC.
It definitely came down to the wire here. I was wondering if you could speak to the challenges and the process leading up to this.
Sure. So being my first time on the bargaining committee, there was a lot to learn, a lot to grasp. Our particular contract is a little bit complicated, but we worked through it and we were able to make some changes that were able to get some funds in the pockets of our members. And we believe we've reached a really good deal. Unfortunately, we're not able to go into details until we fully explain it to our members and get them to ratify it, hopefully this week. But I think we've made a lot of progress. I was really happy with the outcome. I think we made great strides in a lot of non-monetary areas as well, but especially with the deal that finally came across the table. It was a lot of back and forth. It was a lot of restlessness. I've been very, very anxious, but I think all that anxious energy and especially all the preparation we all did. Like, we all got this deal together. We all came together and we got this deal because we were prepared, because we were ready, because we were loud, and I think our voices have been heard, and that's the most gratifying thing.
How are you hoping this can benefit Queen's workers?
Firstly, by making sure our members are paid what they're worth, and making sure the members of all the locals here, like, we were all united on this front. I think we came together and we achieved great strides for everybody. And I hope to see this level of coordination and cooperation in the future. And I think I think overall we're going to see a little bit of relief at the end of the month, because I know for many of us that's a very stressful time when the bills are coming in and the money's just not quite there. So I think this will make a huge impact on the lives of our members, and hopefully, like, with our members being in a better state, we're going to be have more positive interactions with the students, and we're going to be able to deliver services at a greater level than we were before.
Are you hopeful that members will be able to ratify this agreement?
Yes, I'm very hopeful. I'm cautiously optimistic was a word that was thrown around a lot last night, and I'm feeling good. And I think that's the most we can ask for at this point.
Other Queen's workers also had a strong presence at the rally, showing their support for their QB colleagues. Professor Karen Rudy with the Queen's University Faculty Association also spoke with CFRC at the rally.
We recognize as professors that the backbone of the university are many of the QP unions, and we wholeheartedly support them getting better wages and better working conditions.
Final ratification votes will take place in the coming days.
You were just telling me about your umbrella here.
Yes! So my umbrella, it says Stop the Hospital Cuts, was developed by QP and in conjunction with O2 8 years ago. And here I stand again in front of KGH Emerge with this umbrella and my flag, and there's been no resolution. It's been a long fight, and it continues to be a fight.
Would you say it's gotten better or worse?
It's been worse. That's why the stretchers are here, you know? So it's hallway medicine now. The cuts back then, we saw hallway medicine, but not to the degree. So it's just been eroding and eroding year after year after year. And it's disheartening. And we have to ensure in this election that that changes.
Who you just heard from was Julia Lynch, a retiree with QP at a demonstration organized by QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions on Monday outside of Kingston General Hospital. On the eve of the provincial election, O2 QP members and supporters set up a lineup of hospital stretchers outside of Kingston General Hospital, symbolizing, quote, the crisis in Ontario's healthcare. This demonstration is taking place at hospitals across Ontario, with Northumberland, Sudbury, Belleville, Oshawa, London, Peterborough, and more municipalities seeing similar sights this week. Michael Hurley, president of QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions, spoke with CFRC at the demonstration.
You have the stretchers out here in front of Kingston General
Yes.
Hospital. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the symbolism there and why you've decided to demonstrate this way.
Well, the stretchers, you know, represent the 2,000 people who are on stretchers in hospital hallways on any given day in Ontario now. That's up from 850 when the current government promised to eliminate them. But we also want to talk about the fact that there's 250,000 people waiting for surgeries, and that over 11,000 of those people died waiting last year. We want to talk about the 2.5 million people who don't have a family doctor, and the 50,000 people who are waiting for long-term care. So those are all issues that we'd really like to see have more discussion in this election.
As you mentioned, that we do have a specific focus on overcrowding and hallway health care in today's demonstration. Is there anything you could speak a bit about the issues that lead to that and what issues those cause?
Well, the reason that we have this problem is because we have an aging and growing population, and we spend the least of any province and consequently have the fewest hospital beds and hospital numbers of hospital staff to patients of any hospital system in the world with a developed economy. And so the way people experience that is that they are turned away even though they might be acutely ill, or they'll spend days on a stretcher waiting for a bed, or their surgery will be delayed for, you know, a year, for 2 years, in some tragic cases, people will miss an early diagnosis of cancer because they don't have access to the kind of primary care that they should have, the access to a family doctor. And so these are all manifestations of a system which is really struggling as a result of undercapacity.
And I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into the specific issue of hallway healthcare.
Well, this is a really sinister development. I mean, we've closed so many hospital beds in this province. Like in Kingston, you used to have two functioning acute care hospitals. Now you've got one. You've undergone a significant reduction in the number of beds that you have available to the public over the years. But now the population is growing and it's aging. So as people age, they need more care. And where are they looked after? Often they're looked after on stretchers in the hallway. And that deprives people of any privacy or any dignity, and it also subjects them to risk from the close proximity of having people together like this means that the chance of them acquiring a hospital infection like MRSA or C. difficile is significantly higher. And because of the understaffing situation, the risk of medical error for these people and for all the patients in the hospital is significantly increased as well. Anything over 85% capacity, and you have the possibility of medical error going up significantly. And in Ontario, and in a hospital like this one, we operate significantly over 85% capacity.
Mm-hmm. And this is a constant issue, but why specifically today for this demonstration?
Well, in the context of the provincial election, we wanted to try to raise this issue and to popularize it, get people talking about it and encouraging them to talk about their own experiences with healthcare, and demand of all the political parties that they put forward programs that would actually make some meaningful changes. And for example, like, we would call for confirmed funding for a hospital like this one on a five-year basis with a significant infusion of new money with the goal of getting people off the stretchers and off the surgical wait lists. We'd want a commitment like that from a party running for government.
Doug Allen, a senior healthcare researcher at CUPE, provided some key insights from CUPE's research that underscore the challenges facing healthcare workers and the current state of patient care.
Ford ran on a platform of ending hallway healthcare in 2018. We're now 1,034 beds more than when he came to power. It's an over 100% increase. Funding is the lowest across Canada for hospitals of any province. Staff-wise, we're missing about 34,000 staff compared to other provinces on a per capita basis. Because the funding is so low, we're in the first half of this fiscal year, Ontario hospitals have a revenue shortfall of about $800 million. In the case of this hospital here, KHSC, we're running $12.5 million short of funding. The government doesn't make clear funding, and the hospitals just have to muddle through. Michael, I think, mentioned that we have a need for extra beds and that we're running at very high bed occupancies. For KHSC, we need another 56 beds, staffed and beds and in operation, in order to run at a safe level. And because of all of these sorts of backups, and they end up in the emergency room, people can't move out of those beds until they move to other areas, is that fully 82% of patients who are admitted to the hospital at KHSC through the emergency room are not admitted within the target wait time of 8 hours. So, you know, big backups, frustration.
Members of the Kingston Health Coalition were also present to show their support. Co-chair of the Kingston Health Coalition, Joan Jardin, shared what response she's hoping to see from the province.
I want the Ontario government to work with the people to do what's best for people. And that is our public health care system that we fought so hard for. In fact, we shouldn't be fighting for the very basics now. We should be looking to expand and make it better. This is Ontario, Canada. If we can't have good health care in Ontario, Canada, where in the world can we? And I do not believe in the excuse of there is no money, because we've seen where money has been spent. And I would rather the money be spent on people. It's an investment in people. It helps their life, makes it better, and in fact saves money in the long run. It's the most important thing that we can do, and we should actually build on it.
According to a message from the Ministry of Health, the provincial government has made record investments in the publicly funded healthcare system. Since 2018, the province has increased the healthcare budget by over 31%, investing over $85 billion into the system in 2024. The ministry did not respond to requests for additional comments regarding the demonstration from CFRC. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for this morning, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of February 10th, 2025. We begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Market Street, King to Ontario, is closed until February 21st for the Spirit of Winter. Here is a parking disruption you should be aware of. The Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is now underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. This work is planned to conclude in July of 2025. Lastly, here are some other delays you should be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. Daytime high of minus 4 with sunny conditions and an overnight low of minus 10. Saturday, February 15th, daytime high of minus 3 with a 60% chance of flurries throughout the day and an overnight low of minus 10. Sunday, February 16th, daytime high of minus 6 with flurries throughout the day and a warmer overnight low of minus 3. Monday, February 17th is the coldest day of February thus far with a daytime high of minus 10 and an overnight low of minus 19.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. Coming just after difficult budget deliberations last month, Council considered a motion brought forward by Councillor Paul Shaves to look into implementing non-Kingston resident user fees for city facilities and services. The motion cites budget constraints and significant growth pressures, and argues for the importance of residents having equitable and prioritized access to city-owned facilities and services supported by their property taxes. Options suggested in the motion included differential pricing structures for non-residents, priority registration windows for Kingston residents for recreational programs, facility bookings, and other high-demand services, and resident-only access periods or capacity allocations for specific city-owned facilities. Loyalist was the only neighboring municipality explicitly identified in discussion as charging non-resident user fees. Councillor Connie Glenn was the first to bring up concerns with the idea.
You know, I understand the fiscal concerns that we are facing. I mean, we just went through a really difficult budget challenge. But I also am concerned about, to some degree, the neighborliness, if you will put it that way. I'm looking at what's happening in the broader context out here. We've just gone through a tariff scare, and hopefully it stays a scare. But it almost seems a little bit like this, that we're talking about our neighbors next door. And my concern with this motion has to do with that we maintain good relationships, because we don't know when we're going to have to rely on our neighbors for support on something. So I'm okay with having a look at things, but I just want to make sure that we don't overstep in how we approach this, and that we give consideration to the mutual support that we need to have in our region. So I'm going to leave it at that. I just find myself discomforted by the fact that we're bringing this kind of emotion.
Councillor Ryan Bohm brought up similar worries, also referencing the recent threats of tariffs from the United States.
My one concern here is just in light of sort of what's going on with the states right now is, you know, are we going to start a resident, non-resident user fee war with all our neighbors, and all of a sudden everybody's trying to outdo each other, and it just becomes this, you know, leapfrog effect where everybody's constantly raising their fees for non-residents.
Councillor Jeff McLaren also took issue with the idea, citing larger value-based concerns.
I'm very, very much against the very principle that this represents. We are setting up discriminatory walls. And it seems that other municipalities have also done that already. And we are going to just encourage this. It seems to be getting more. And where does it stop? Are we going to block everybody at some point because they're not paying taxes here? That doesn't seem to be part of the spirit of not discriminate against place of origin. We do have that as one of the principles that we live on in this country. And let's consider what we're doing here. We're actually going to create two tiers of citizenship or residency based on where you live. That doesn't seem right. There's something very wrong about that. Public amenities should be public, and equally so. There are lots of parks in Kingston that I don't visit, but I still pay taxes to fund that. Do we want to have the idea that, hey, if we don't use a particular amenity, I don't want to pay for it? We are being, this seems to me that we're being mean and petty and discriminatory.
Councillor Jimmy Hassan brought up his personal experience accessing local facilities, also arguing that Kingston should prioritize its taxpayers.
I remember that when me and my wife was waking up 4 o'clock, get into the line at the YMCA for the swimming lessons. And we are a taxpayer from 2005 since I bought my first house. And we are still paying taxes, and I see the still same situation from the Kingston resident. The long lines, and you know, they have to wake up early, and then still, it's not that we are opposing on them and forcing them to do that, but it's a lack of availability because the other people, other non-resident also in standing up in the line probably in front of them. And about the tariff, you know, we are not trading anything with them. So we are just offering them facilities here. When you use Frontenac transportation, you pay for them. We use their facility for ambulance, we pay for it. Or they pay to us too. It's no such a tariff thing. It's not terrible things. Asking a fair share to maintain the cost of it. They are welcome to use anytime. They can get into the line with our resident, but they have to pay a little bit more because our taxpayer paying the taxes to use the services from the city, and they deserve better and first.
After hearing from councillors, Mayor Brian Patterson made a final statement and requested that council wait for him to discuss the issue with other mayors.
I think this is about fairness. And you can be neighborly and talk about fairness. Right. So the last couple of years, the mayors of all of our neighboring municipalities have been meeting. And it's been good discussions. And you know what we talk about? We talk about, are there ways that we may need to work together so that not every municipality is investing in the same thing? That maybe there are ways that we can partner and we can create, for example, recreational facilities that maybe can be shared. This, in my view, is just part of that discussion. We're just getting some information about potential possibilities about, okay, if we want to finance new pools or new arenas in the future that are very expensive or other facilities, that we can have those discussions to say, okay, well, there are different ways that, you know, if Kingston was to take the lead on it, the ways that we could look at different fee structures, or we could look at different partnerships, as we've done so with Loyalist. And maybe there are other municipalities that may want to do the same thing with us, right? There's really nothing unneighborly about this. I think right now it's about getting information. I think what would be key is if council would indulge me, is if the information comes back and we think we want to discuss it further, then I would ask that you allow me to speak to the other mayors first so that we can have those discussions. So it's not something that we're just imposing unilaterally, but we're having those very open discussions about, we're trying to figure out how to finance those pieces. These are fair and reasonable discussions that happen all the time between municipalities. So I think that we can all agree that the spirit around this table is not in any way antagonistic. It's just about figuring out how we can do more.
In the end, most councillors were open to exploring the idea, with only councillors Glenn and McLaren opposed. City staff will report back to council with research and recommendations for implementing non-Kingston resident fees in time to be considered as part of the 2026 municipal budget process. At their meeting last week, councillors chose to move forward with a motion proposing a new maximum temperature bylaw for residential rental units. While landlords in Ontario are required to provide a minimum level of heat, the same obligation does not exist for air conditioning. The motion suggested an amendment to the existing property standards bylaw requiring landlords or property owners of residential units with air conditioning systems to maintain a temperature not exceeding 26 degrees Celsius from June 1st to September 30th. Environmental and health advocates believe the motion did not go far enough, requesting that the requirement extend to rental units that do not already have air conditioning installed. Anne Fu, Commissioner of Environmental Sustainability with the Queen's University Alma Mater Society, made the case for this amendment before council.
While I am grateful that the city has decided to put forward a motion to adopt a maximum allowable temperature in rental units, I'm disappointed to see that the language only applies to rental units that already have air conditioning systems. Many of Kingston's most precarious renters don't live in units with air conditioning systems in the first place and cannot afford to have them installed on behalf of the landlord. This motion won't help them access cooling, nor anyone else who is low income, disabled, or chronically ill, elderly, or supporting a family. I also want to say that although these testimonies are collected from the student district, this likely applies to many other tenants in many other areas of Kingston. We need a bylaw that not only establishes a maximum temperature in rental units, but that does so in a way that doesn't pass the cost on to tenants, and that protects all Kingstonians, regardless of their ability to afford housing and cooling technologies. Through this bylaw, Kingston has a critical opportunity to stand up for the health and safety of its most vulnerable citizens and become a leader alongside other municipalities in Ontario working towards similar laws, including Toronto and Hamilton.
Councillor Jeff McLaren presented a petition with over 1,500 signatures from environmental organizations Seniors for Climate Action Now and 350 Kingston, urging the province of Ontario to direct landlords to keep temperatures in all rental units below 26 degrees Celsius during the summer without passing on costs to residents and tenants. Dr. Henry Swoboda, an emergency physician with Kingston Health Sciences Centre, also spoke before council, stating that this is a necessary step to protect public health.
I've seen firsthand the devastating impact of extreme heat, and I have seen what happens when we fail to prepare for predictable disasters due to upfront costs. We see costs in human lives as well as downstream dollar costs that overwhelm our healthcare system. When patients come into the ER with heat illness, I often hear two things from them and their families. One is, I didn't think it was that hot, and two is, we just checked on them and thought they were all right. These statements reveal a dangerous reality. Heat can be sneaky. This isn't just about discomfort, it's about life and death.
A report by the Intact Center on Climate Adaption at Waterloo University named Kingston as one of the Canadian cities projected to be most exposed to extreme heat as the impacts of climate change become more prevalent. According to the report from city staff, very few municipalities in Ontario have a standalone adequate temperature bylaw, with Hamilton and Toronto currently exploring their options to enact a bylaw which would include rental units that do not currently have air conditioning. Robert Mello with the Kingston Property Rental Association, representing about 75 members with thousands of rental units, came to speak against the motion, claiming that the cost to landlords would be too high.
Possible solutions must involve all levels of government providing incentives to make necessary capital improvements. We must work together to meet these challenges. This downloading of costs onto landlords is unsustainable. We do know that there's a number of older buildings here. And of course, a lot of these buildings have tenants that have been there for 10 years and more, and they're paying, you know, somewhere between $600 and $1,000 per month rent when hydro alone, this doesn't include sewer and water, hydro alone is $300 in the month. So it's basically going to push them out of the business. And the low rents, it's just going to be another excuse to just abandon the property or sell it there's going to have an effect on housing for sure in the city, guaranteed.
Mello also stressed that the majority of units do not currently have air conditioning installed. When it came time for councillors to discuss, the city's lawyer Jenna Morley warned council that the city may not have the authority to mandate a maximum temperature in all rental units, as air conditioning is not included in landlord obligations in existing provincial legislation.
I'm going to decline to provide any further legal advice in open session this evening, but I would certainly advise council against hastily enacting a bylaw on uncertain jurisdictional grounds without an appreciation for the knock-on effects of that bylaw.
In the end, amendments were made to the motion, and it was decided that council will await the results of the push for this legislation in Toronto and Hamilton, or changes to provincial legislation that would allow the municipality to assuredly move forward with this mandate for all residential units. Councillor Vincent Shinani had the following comment on the amendments.
It could end up being where, say, these other municipalities that are trying to implement this, that they may run into roadblocks or do something like not properly, where we can evaluate that and say, okay, well, this is the mistakes that were made there. Then if we try a different way, learn from their mistakes, or maybe it's successful and then we'd be like, okay, and we could just duplicate it.
Councillor Brandon Tozo wrapped up his time stating the following.
I think if we vote this motion, we're going to frustrate both people who are advocating for tenants, and we're going to frustrate landlords who are not quite happy with this. everyone's going to walk out of the room a little bit unhappy, which says to me what the municipality is doing tonight is adequate.
The amended motion passed with a vote of 12-1, with Councillor Gary Osteroff opposed. City staff will report back to council in the coming months with the necessary amending bylaw to provide a new maximum temperature for residential units with air conditioning systems. Other actions in the motion include advocacy to the provincial government and the development of a heat response strategy in partnership with the Southeast Health Unit. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Bruce Kuwabara celebrated Canadian architect and the mind behind Agnes Reimagine, the new home of the Agnes Etherington Art Centre, is this year's Francis K. Smith Lecturer in Canadian Art. In his talk, Catalyzing Change, Kuwabara presents several recent projects that explore the themes of art and community and the insights he gained working on Agnes Reimagined. Join us on Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. in Grant Hall for this exciting event. Tickets are free, but please register by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this January and February at the Broom Factory, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local favorites. On January 18th, don't miss Canadian alt-rock duo, Mountainhead. January 24th features local indie rock outfit, Cassador. On January 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from local electronic artist Kakao's latest EP, Dope. Breaking new sonic boundaries, this EP marks an evolution in Kakao's distinctive electronic funk sound. Deep basses, vocal sampling, and progressive ideas ultimately shape this three-track collection of nothing but bangers. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Dope by Kakao on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Melt with us right now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
CFRC listeners, in celebration of International Women's Day, local icon Miss Emily and the Kingston Music Office are hosting an International Women's Day showcase on March 7th at the Broom Factory, with support from your friends here at CFRC. Experience a showcase celebrating the remarkable talents of women and non-binary artists in the Kingston community. Miss Emily will be hosting the night with feature performances from Clara Smallman, Julia Finnegan, Kyra Daniel, and Savannah Shea. Stay for the fireside chat exploring songwriting, creativity, and the challenges of navigating the music industry as underrepresented voices, as well as a showcase of women-led businesses in the Kingston community. It's sure to be the event of the season. Doors are at 7 p.m., and tickets can be found at ticketscene.ca.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection called Mist Like Ghost Like from Left-Handed Archer's new album. With immersive ambient soundscapes, limitless texture, and industrial techno rhythms, the band's sophomore record, The Animal Vector, explores humanity's tenuous relationship to nature and the consequences of our endless expansion of industry. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Animal Vector by Left-Handed Archer on your favorite platforms and enjoy Mist Like Ghost Like from that album right here now with us on CFRC 101.9 FM.
On Saturday, March 8 at 7 p.m., join the Agnes Etherington Art Center as they bring back their popular series, Open Secret. In this third edition, the Agnes partners with New York Film Festival, Prismatic Ground, and its artistic director, Inay Prakash, for a screening of five short works by filmmakers exploring the gaps in their relationships to ancestral homelands, including the earth upon which Canada has imposed its borders. From Palestine to Algeria to Haiti to China, the faint outlines of nations dissolve beneath a vivid 16-millimeter overlay of memory and imagination. A Q&A with Prakash will follow the screenings. This event is free and takes place at the screening room. Save your spot today by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
Who is this irresistible creature who has an insatiable love for the dead?
Tune in on Tuesdays at 3 p.m. for Dark Side of the Tune with me, your host, Tommy. The show where we look at the weird, the moody, the loud, and the unabashed. If the song falls on the dark side of music, then you can bet that we will play it. So join me Tuesdays at 3 p.m. See you there.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University.